Brilliant. Let's get going. Thanks everybody for joining us. Welcome to 2025. Happy New Year to you all. Hope you had a good festive period. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter. I'm a partner with Specialist Employment and Business Immigration Practice, MPM Legal. Delighted as ever to be joined by my colleague, Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Good morning and happy new year, everybody who's come to join us again today. And here we go.
Yeah, new season four already. I think we're over, we're up to about 60 episodes, I think. So really in the swing of these sessions. Just a couple of housekeeping points before we get into it today. Those of you who join us regularly will know we absolutely love questions. So if you want to ask any questions for us to deal with during the course of this session today, just use the Q&A function down at the bottom because it helps us manage them. If you want to chat to any of the other participants, then you can use the chat functionality at the bottom and just send the message if you are so inclined. So today we are having a look to kick off this season, just what's on the horizon for 2025. It's going to be quite a year of change. We absolutely promise we're not going to labour anything on the Employment Rights Bill, if you pardon the pun, because we've
Terrible.
spoken about that an awful lot, haven't we?
Yeah, we
In
have.
the past.
And we all know that that's made provision for a whole load of changes, including unfair dismissal, fire and rehire, collective redundancies, 0 hours contracts, which I was listening to a commentator talking about the McDonald's situation on 0 hours contracts the other day. It was quite interesting. So we'll see how the government reacts to that. And yeah, a whole raft of other things. That was published on in October 2024, and basically it sets out there's a bunch of steps that the government's going to have to follow following the publication of that bill. But many of the policies that are contained will have further details that will have to be provided. But this is going to be done through partnership with businesses, workers, trade unions. And actually, recently this morning, I don't know if you got it, Peter, I got a notification that a number of trade unions are clubbing together to back the safe sick pay, it's called, to ensure changes to sick pay go through. But in any event, there's an awful lot of consultation processes to come through where stakeholders will have their opportunities to give input, etc., and all the rest of it. So this is going to be a busy year, I think, for consultations, which will then the outcome of that will go in the supporting legislation to drive through the changes that Labour's looking to make. So busy year, busy year.
Yeah, absolutely. I think just on that point about McDonald's and the harassment that you mentioned, I saw so some snippets online. McDonald's are giving evidence to the Parliamentary Select Committee, who are, as part of their remit, I think, inviting consultation on the Employment Rights Bill changes. And I don't know if the commentator you read, Adrian, was talking about the same thing that I saw, where the committee were making the point around, well, or asking McDonald's view on, do you think that 0 hours contracts create a kind of weakness in the bargaining position, and
Absolutely.
people are, more exposed to harassment in the workplace because they're going to be worried about speaking up and doing something about it for fear of missing out on shifts. Just like the
Absolutely.
thrust of it. And you
Yeah,
can see the
exactly.
logic there. But actually, I thought, I don't know if you saw McDonald's response at all. I thought I don't know if it was UKMD that was giving evidence, but a senior manager in the UK business, I thought dealt with it pretty well in terms of saying like, everybody, and I wasn't aware of this, everybody within the business has the option to elect for permanent contract
Permanent
hours.
contract.
But actually,
Yeah.
a load of our employees are under the age of 25. They don't want to be working when they're doing exams if they're university students or A-level students. They want to fit things around other things if they're going off and doing stuff. And the 0 hours contract actually gives a lot of flexibility. And that's always been the counter argument, hasn't it, for the use of 0 hours contracts.
Yeah, and you get loads of people saying that that 0 hours really works for them. You know,
Yeah.
that they can look on their phones, they can see what shifts are being offered, and they can click a button to say, yes, I do want them, or no, I don't, or they just ignore it if not, and there's no ramifications for that. So I think, you know, the flip side of the coin is that for a lot of people, it really works. But yeah, the point in the context of this harassment thing is people are, well, the argument is that people are too scared to speak up, particularly if they say to their manager, I need you to stop what you're doing, or I need you to investigate this, because the manager might then go, oh, well, they're a troublemaker, and therefore I'm not going to make that shift available to them. them. And I think that was the experience of some of the people that were being interviewed when I was listening on the radio. So it's a tricky one. It's a tricky one. And it's
It's a
tricky for a
difficult.
business to manage that sort of flex and shrink that it needs, that a lot of businesses need depending on the times of the year. So I'd be really interested to see what the consultation process brings out on that. But my feeling is that there's an awful lot to weigh against it, so I wouldn't be surprised if they if it is done away with.
No, absolutely not.
I'm not making a bet on it, just saying.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I think someone's just knocked on my door, actually, and I have to answer this. Can you just talk for 30 seconds and I'll be back. One second.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so I'm going to talk about what we thought we'd talk about aside from the Employment Rights Bill is some other changes and other bits of legislation that are coming in this year. So I am going to talk about the Neonatal Care Leave and Pay Act, which received royal assent back in 2023 and was expected to come into force in April 2025 under the previous Conservative government. This date hasn't been confirmed by the current government, but it does look like it is going to go ahead because we know that HMRC has published a policy paper on the tax treatment of statutory neonatal care pay. So what is it? Well, it's come about because a number of parents who unfortunately suffered difficulties when their newborns were born, in that they were had to stay in hospital for a lengthy period of time before they could start enjoying their various forms of parental leave. So what this act aims to do is to bring in additional leave, so statutory neonatal leave and pay for up to 12 weeks for parents of babies that do require neonatal care. And that needs to be taken within 68 weeks of the birth. And the idea of that is that it works alongside additional entitlements like maternity and paternity leave and can be tacked on to the end. So in other words, if somebody unfortunately has to stay in hospital with their baby for a period of weeks, their maternity leave will start, but they will be able to add up to 12 weeks on as this additional leave at the end of their maternity leave. That's how it's going to work. It's going to be a day one right, which matches existing maternity leave. Although we believe that eligibility to receive the statutory pay, which will be at the same statutory rates, will require 26-week service, as is currently the case with maternity pay. So I think it's a really good step forward to assist parents who find themselves in that situation.
Definitely. We've had some questions on that, not in the session today. I just mean generally from businesses asking about that coming online. So that policy paper from HMRC is probably worth a thumb through if you're encountering those issues at work. I'm going to jump back to what I was going to talk about, Adrian, which is this Draft Equality and Race and Disability Bill. So yeah, excuse my absence, the perils of home working and deliveries. What we've got coming down the line is a draft Equality, Race and Disability Bill, which I'll call the Race and Disability Bill, was one of the announcements set out in the King's Speech. Obviously, this is separate bit of legislation to the Employment Rights Bill. And this is all about Labour's manifesto commitment to enshrine the full right to equal pay in law for ethnic minorities and disabled people. What we're expecting to see now is a significant period of consultation on the draft bill. But this, we think, is going to be at a much slower pace to what's going on with the Employment Rights Bill, which is kind of full speed ahead, really, isn't it? So the focus is on the Employment Rights Bill. We've got this other bit of legislation ticking along in the background. What is it going to do? Well, two main things. The first is it's going to enshrine in law the full right to equal pay for ethnic minorities and disabled people, and to make it easier for them to bring unequal pay claims, because there are some challenges at the moment in terms of how you formulate, a claim without getting into the weeds of the technicalities of that. But there are barriers if you want to bring a pay discrimination claim on the grounds of ethnicity or on the grounds of disability. The second thing it does is, and this could entail a lot of work, is introducing mandatory ethnicity and disability pay reporting for employers with 250 or more employees. Now, those of you who fall into that category will, of course, be familiar with gender pay gap reporting and all the rules which have been in play for quite a while now. So it's an extension of that really. And the idea is to close the ethnicity and disability pay gaps and to help, the government would say, employers constructively consider why they exist and how to tackle them. Now, there's potentially a lot of work there because, like we saw when gender pay gap reporting came in, you've got to have the system set up to be able to scrape the data, obtain the data, to understand exactly what's going on. And, that's where we saw some employers encounter difficulties when gender pay gap reporting came in terms of whether the systems were set for fit for purpose and whether they actually had the raw data available to be able to get the information they needed to comply with the duties to report.
It's tricky that, isn't it? Because all
It
the
is.
equal opportunities forms that, you typically might send out with your offer letters, etc., all the rest of it, they're all optional, they're not mandatory. And it's therefore quite difficult for employers who may not have that data already to go back and gather that, but also how to gather it going forward. I mean, I think this was something that came up at the time, so it's going to be exactly the same type of issue now, I think.
Yeah, same sort of challenges. So, you've got plenty of advance notification that this is potentially going to be coming in. And so you might need to start thinking now about can we do more in terms of the data we're collecting about the makeup of our workforce. But yeah, I mean, it's absolutely the case that, of course, we know not every disability is visible. Right? Disabilities manifest themselves in different ways. And it's you can't look at somebody and make a determination from looking at them whether they're disabled or not. And equally, ethnicity is so varied as well. And you can't make assumptions
Absolutely.
about people's ethnicity either.
And
So
also c clumping it together as one sort of like end ethnicity, it's going that I think that in itself is going to be really tricky because I think businesses are going to have to be extremely careful in terms of how that's broken down. So
absolutely.
it's a minefield, I think.
And it's one for our friends over at NPM Included, I think, in terms of the tools that they've got. They do a lot of work on gender pay gap reporting and have developed certain tools to be able to obtain and then analyze the data. And this feeds in to that as well. So we know from the Next Steps paper that the government's going to create a new regulatory enforcement unit for equal pay as well. And in fact, we did a special session on equal pay claims. I think we looked at the next equal pay decision and we looked at what's going on in Sainsbury's and some of the supermarkets and how that translates into practical points for businesses to be thinking about. That was only about 4 or 5 episodes ago, I think. So probably November, December time, we did that. So go back and have a look on Spotify for that episode. Adrian, I think you're going to talk about the right to disconnect, which is another fairly hot potato, isn't it?
Isn't it just? And I thought I might just disconnect right now because the sun's out. So that's it. I'm off. Over to you. I mean, I think this came out in the plan to make work pay, stating that this new right to switch off would be introduced, providing workers with the right to disconnect outside of working hours and not be contacted by their employer. Now, I mean, this is following similar models. I think we've touched on this before, which are already in place in Ireland and Belgium and probably other jurisdictions as well, giving workers and employers the opportunity to have those types of constructive conversations, work together on workplace policies or contractual terms that work for both parties. So there's nothing on this new right in the Employment Rights Bill, and in the Next Steps paper that the government confirmed that it would take forward the right to switch off, but through a statutory code of practice. So we expect there's going to be consultation on what this code of practice might look like in 2025. Now, I mean, I think that's quite an interesting one, I think, because it's obviously taking steps towards dealing with what people are grappling with in HR and other places of burnout and illness and stress at work, etc., all the rest of it. But if you flip that on its head as well, you've also got the issue of our economy, where a lot of our practice at the moment is unfortunately dealing with redundancies, where costs need to be cut. But of course, the nub of the issue is that the work is still there, but possibly with fewer people to do it. So I think this is going to be a very emotive issue. And yeah, I'm not quite sure how it's necessarily going to work. But I mean, a lot of companies will already say, and I've seen this, haven't you, Peter, on the bottom of people's emails going, just because I sent this to you outside of working hours, don't feel you have to respond. You know, so it's a case of some people like to clear their inboxes. But that's the tricky thing as well, because if you get an email from your manager because you're looking on at your phone while, you know, sitting on the sofa watching telly in the evening, that does unsettle quite a lot of employees, even if they're not expected to answer. Anyway, so a whole load of emotional issues tied up with that one. So let's see what that code of practice comes out and see what business input is in the consultation.
Yeah, I think the debate around that is going to be similar to the current debate on hybrid working and return to office mandates, which there seems to be an ever increasing number of media articles about return to office mandates. And my personal take on that is there's not a one size fits all approach.
No.
I mean, I think some even for some even between office based or traditional office-based businesses, some will operate in a way that it really suits them to have a hybrid model, and others will work in a way that it doesn't suit them at all for their own particular reasons. And I don't think you can have a kind of blanket approach that applies across sectors and across industries and even across employers within sectors and industries as well. And I think it's going to be the same in terms of right to disconnect as well.
Yeah, maybe it's
And
in, maybe it'll be employee led, so they can make the request, and then a business will have some parameters around what their policy might look like. You know, so don't know, be very
Yeah.
interesting.
Watch this space. We'll
I
keep
wonder if
you.
anybody's already got it in place already.
Yeah, I'd be curious to know actually if anyone works in an organization that has it, then let us know.
Yeah,
Because we
yeah.
would be interested.
We just had one comment come up, which
Yeah,
I
go
think is
on.
really interesting, actually. And it's a bit like what we were talking about with the McDonald's, like the fear to speak up for failure for fear of losing some shifts. One of our regular attendees, thank you, has made the comment that perhaps with the increase of redundancies that will take place, employees will be more inclined not to disconnect and be more attentive to employer needs. I guess the next part of that comment would be for fear of being added to the list because they were being seen to want to disconnect. So I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah, and then a follow-up question: is there an anticipated date for the right to switch off? I think it's just going to be. Well, there isn't a date yet.
No.
There's going to be
We
consultation on it,
expect,
but I think
yeah,
it's
we
going to be
expect
a
consultation this year.
statutory code of practice rather than an actual rule,
Yeah.
which is going to. We're seeing some variants of it across EU member states where some are stricter than others, and I forget whether it's Germany or France where there's an absolute.
I
Right.
think it's
Or is it
France.
Belgium as well,
No, I think it's
actually?
France. I think France is really strict on it because of their working hours as well. So, yeah.
But we're not anticipating a rule that says everybody absolutely
You
has a
must.
right to disconnect. It's going to be a code of practice on it and recommendations for employers
Yeah.
to follow. I just want to quickly mention something about employment tribunal reforms. I know it's not going to be applicable to absolutely everybody that's listening to this, but for those of you that are in the position of responding to employment tribunal claims from time to time. Just be aware that earlier this week, some new employment tribunal rules came into effect. Really, a lot of it is renumbering and referencing of different applicable rules. So it's just making sure you identify the new rule if you're making applications and dealing with some procedural stuff. The more practical change that may affect you is that. Email is a method of presenting a response. So, emailing the employment tribunal with your response form as an attachment is not going to be allowed anymore unless it's exceptional circumstances. What you need to do is respond either online, and there's an online portal, which I've always found to be pretty effective actually, for submitting the response, or you can do it by post or by hand. And maybe by
Yeah.
carrier pigeon as well, because it feels a bit archaic to be sending post out, but you
Yeah. Although
cannot
they
send
post
it
the
by
claims
email.
out, which is really annoying.
Oh yeah, of
As one of
course.
my clients found out that it landed on at their offices during the Christmas break. But anyway, for those of you that want to find the online response that and don't know where it is, if you just Google responding to a tribunal claim or being taken to an employment tribunal claim, it's in that. If you go to that, it takes you to a government page, and then about halfway down you can click a button which says respond online, and that's where you find the online form, just in case anybody wants to find it. If I was clever enough to post it in the chat, then I would, but maybe I'll figure that out.
Yeah, while I'm talking to you about
Yeah.
artificial intelligence in the workplace, which again is another hot topic, and it's and I was reading some articles over the Christmas period talking about how long it's going to be before employers can effectively buy in AI workers, so an AI tool that for all intents and purposes will do the job of an employed person, and it's going to be offered as a service. So that's the path that we're going down. Obviously, this is a kind of we're at the sharp end of development here because it's all new for everybody, and we're going to see a lot of change within a very short period of time. The government's next steps paper said that a consultation would be issued on how to implement measures on surveillance technologies, as well as negotiations with trade unions and staff representatives. And in the King's speech, the government said that they will seek to establish the appropriate legislation to place requirements on those working to develop the most powerful artificial intelligence models. The concern is that regulators are not equipped at the moment sufficiently to deal with the pace of development that this new technology is bringing. So the government feels that it's having to play catch up. And, I think understandably, the government is also concerned about the appropriate rights and protections and safeguards that are in place with AI tools. So, I mean, you and I have talked about this in other sessions about AI
Discrimination
and
and
discrimination, and particularly
yeah.
how machine learning, if it's based on discriminatory data, so it's learned from discriminatory data, discrimination is then going to be baked in to the learned system. And so you're going to get discriminatory outcomes as well. And the government, understandably, is saying we want appropriate safeguards to make sure that that's not going to be happening. The other risk around this, like I've mentioned, is use of surveillance technologies and AI in terms of employee monitoring and where you draw the line. We've seen employers criticized in years gone by for using technology like keystroke counters, measuring keystroke speed. And also, one employer, I think, fitted devices to be able to monitor whether people were actually sat at their desk and how many breaks they were taking. I think that was a prominent newspaper publisher that took that one. So again, the government is going to be consulting with trade unions about surveillance as well. So we can just expect to see some consultations coming out during the course of 2025 on AI in the workforce. When you look at what the EU are doing, and we like to look at what the EU are doing because quite often the provisions will trickle down over to us, they're being a lot more interventionist. So there's a new EU AI Act, which was adopted in May of last year. And they also brought in the Platform Workers Directive in December 2024. And what that means is member states have got 2 years to incorporate this Platform Workers Directive into national legislation. What does it do? Well, it's all about promoting transparency, fairness, and accountability in algorithmic management used in platform work. So what we're talking about are things like how drivers who work on platform apps are allocated jobs, for example. And we saw that case in the UK system, in the employment tribunal system, either last year or the year before, where a discrimination claim was brought. I think it was settled prior to a judgment, actually. But the claim was basically that the facial recognition software for someone to get onto the platform was racially discriminatory in respect of a particular user, and a race discrimination claim was brought. So the EU are a little bit ahead in terms of the steps that they're taking there, but there's going to be a lot of consultation on that. Finally, if you're interested in AI and managing AI risk as well, I just want to call out some guidance that was published by both the government and the Information Commissioner's Office, specifically aimed at AI use in HR and recruitment. And obviously, that's going to be of interest to quite a lot of you. So There's some ICO guidance that came out in November 2024, and that just talks to risk assessments, due diligence you need to take with suppliers of AI systems. So, in particular, if you're working with external recruiters who are using AI to perhaps filter applicants for roles that you've got open, it's worth a page turn of that note as well. Another really hot topic, Adrienne, gender identity, gender critical beliefs.
Yeah, I mean, one of many hot topics. If we go back to our conversations previously about the rise of mental health in the workplace, but this one is a highly charged issue with really polarized views about, you know, on the one hand, you've got a transgender person's right to have their identity recognized, and then on the other hand, the gender critical beliefs that a person's sex is an immutable biological fact and that someone's gender is different from their sex. So, massive amount in the press. And, you know, on X and all the other platforms where people are talking about this, but it's also been addressed in quite a few cases. And I think that's only going to be on the increase. So recent case laws recognise that gender critical beliefs, i.e., that sex is an immutable biological fact, is something that is being that is capable of protection under the Equality Act as a philosophical belief. So there was one particular case where a barrister, Ms. Bailey, she sued her chambers in London and Stonewall for discrimination because of her gender critical beliefs. Now she'd tweeted against Stonewall's campaign for gender self-identification, i.e. that they can just produce a gender identification certificate. And the tribunal decided that her belief came within the scope of protection under the Equality Act. I mean, this... This is just provides ground for massive conflict with other protected characteristics, including the protected characteristic of gender reassignment. And it is a big challenge for employers who are responsible for preventing discrimination and harassment in the workplace. And it's a really tricky legal issue. I think a lot of it is going to be fact sensitive, because I think one of the things that does that people do need to remember is while there is that inherent conflict, that one discrimination or one set of beliefs that could be protected can then conflict with another set. Don't forget the way in which somebody might demonstrate their beliefs may not be protected, because it's all about the behavior that has been exhibited. So much is going to depend on that behavior and how that impacts on the rights of others not to be discriminated against. So it's not an easy topic, but
Yeah, I mean, I can sort of bring that to life in terms of a practical example of how it could play out in the workplace, and that's somebody who has gender critical views, a gender critical belief, let's say because of religious reasons, and doesn't wish to refer to somebody by their preferred pronouns. And there've been a couple of tribunal cases that I've looked at this issue, and the trap for the employer is taking a stance that the gender critical beliefs are not capable of being protected under the Equality Act as either a religious belief or a philosophical belief, and they may well be. And also, what the employer's got to be mindful of is a duty of care towards somebody who is perhaps being misgendered, because that could be an act of harassment for
Right,
which
so
the
that's the
employer could be
behavior
liable.
rather
That's
than
the
the
behaviour.
belief. Yeah, exactly. So it's like it's the message is, you know, it's you can have your beliefs, that's absolutely fine. Just be careful how you express them, because in the manner in which you express them, that means that you could be submitting another employee to harassment or an act of discrimination. And that's, I mean, that is a tightrope of a fine line though, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah,
So anyway, there we go.
absolutely.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. I interrupted you.
No, that's fine. I was just going to kind of wrap up on this and say that there's one case that's been appealed and was heard by the Supreme Court in at the back end of last year. And that was a Scottish case where the inner house of the Court of Session in Scotland confirmed that the definition of woman in the Equality Act includes trans women with a gender recognition certificate. So we'll need to keep our eye out on the appeal for that, but that's obviously a Scottish case. But then in May 2024, the Minister for Women and Equalities issued a call for input seeking examples of policies or guidance issued by public bodies or those that advise public and private organisations which might wrongly suggest that people without a gender certificate have a legal right to access single-sex spaces. According to their self-identified gender. Now, there was a co that call for input closed on the 26th of June. I'm not aware that there's been any output from that call for input, but that's also something to look out for. But undoubtedly, a highly emotionally charged topic for sure.
Yeah, and I know that there's a couple, or at least one case. I think we're waiting for the judgment from the Employment Appeals Tribunal as well in relation to this area. So it is going to pop up in terms of your alerters, developments on this. So look out for that. That's it for this session today. We did just want to give you an intro into what's coming down the line in 2025, other than the monolith that is the Employment Rights Bill, and we're going to be talking loads more on that. We're back into our 2 week cycle, so we're going to be back here in 2 weeks' time. If you want to catch up on any of our previous episodes on equal pay, on the Employment Rights Bill, on a wrap up from 2024, they are all live both on our website, NPM Legal. They're also on Spotify and Amazon Music as well. So just look for Employment Law 101. You'll be able to find those. In terms of the rest of the sessions, Adrienne, we're looking at things slightly differently next
Yeah,
week, I think.
we thought we'd do it a little bit differently because so far what we've done in previous seasons is we've done sort of like high level sessions on the main principles of managing employee relationships, so looking at disciplinary processes, performance management, and then we've done some deeper dives into each of these issues. So this season we thought that we would basically take advantage of the many court cases that are reported in the news, which I'm sure that you all read on a day-to-day basis, and use those as sort of the platform to talk through not really, not just the case, but sort of the do's and don'ts that have cropped up in one of those cases. So we use that to showcase and reinforce some of the principles we've talked about. And that, as Peter says, is alongside bringing you the legislative developments over the course of the year. So we really look forward to you joining us throughout this season. And here's to a productive 2025.
Absolutely, productive and busy. That's it for today. Thanks for joining us. Recording will go live next week and hope to see you in 2 weeks' time. Thanks very much.